This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Paul Ingalls. Today, a profile in peace as we explore the life of Ralph Johnson Bunch.
These successful armistice negotiations have demonstrated conclusively the ability of the United Nations to mediate a serious conflict and to avert a dangerous threat to the peace.
That's United Nations diplomat Ralph Bunch at the docks in New York, returning to the United States on boat after securing the first major Arab-Israeli armistice in 1949. Bunch's successful mission earned him the world's top honor in peacemaking.
The scene is a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly at Flushing Meadow. A UN official walks in, almost unnoticed except by the alert newsreel cameraman. He is Dr. Ralph Bunch, who only a few hours before was announced winner of the 1950 Nobel Peace Prize. First Negro ever to win the award, he is warmly congratulated.
For over 25 years after World War II ended, the fledgling United Nations turned again and again to Ralph Bunch to lead peacemaking missions around the globe. A tireless proponent of human and civil rights, Bunch was instrumental in cooling down hot spots through negotiation and setting the world stage for the transformation from colonial rule to independence for nations in Africa and Asia. In the 1950s, he was also put in charge of setting up the International Atomic Energy Agency and its Atoms for Peace project, exploring peaceful uses for atomic energy. Today on Peace Talks Radio, we'll highlight just a few chapters from this remarkable life, and try to take away some lessons about peacemaking, as we talk to Bunch's UN colleague and biographer, Sir Brian Urquhart, William Greaves, a filmmaker who produced a PBS documentary on Bunch, Tanya Covington, a diversity trainer inspired by Ralph Bunch, and with Ralph Bunch Jr., son of the late Ralph Bunch. Born to humble circumstances in Detroit in 1904, Ralph Bunch was inspired by proud parents and a grandmother determined to see that he was not intimidated by any circumstance or racial prejudice. Bunch was educated at UCLA and later Harvard and taught at Howard University in Washington, D.C. At each institution, he wrote compellingly about the need for governments around the world to live up to the kind of ideals expressed in the U.S. Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and the Constitution. One historian said he was not only a role model for African Americans, but was also a role model for anyone and everyone when it comes to human relations.
Well, I think that's absolutely true.
Sir Brian Urquhart is a former Undersecretary of the United Nations, who worked with Ralph Bunch for 20 years until Bunch's death at the age of 67 in 1971.
Ralph himself, though he was extremely proud of his African American background, very much disliked the idea that he was the first American Negro to do this or that, or that he was in some way different from everybody else. He saw the whole human race as not as brothers, but as people who deserve to be helped and whose problems he wished to devote his life to. And that's what he did pretty consistently right from his relatively early days.
Ralph Bunch, an outstanding athlete and scholar in school at UCLA, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, and he delivers the class valedictory address at graduation. Even just in his 20s, the words in the speech that he called the fourth dimension of personality seem to hold a lot of what will drive him throughout his entire life. Let me just read a little bit of this. It says, "Man learns and knows, but he does not do as well as he knows. This is his weakness. The future peace and harmony of the world are contingent upon the ability, yours and mine, to effect a remedy." This was really kind of a signpost for the rest of his days, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I think Ralph, from an extraordinarily early time, just let's go back a bit. I mean, he was headed for the usual kind of purely employment-favorable kind of what passed for an education for young black men in Los Angeles in 1920. And his grandmother, who was virtually illiterate, had insisted that he not have that kind of education, that he go into the serious subjects that white boys went into. And in Ralph's case, that was very much politics, international politics, and political science. And I think once that field had been opened up to him, he realized the extraordinary gap between knowledge and actual performance, particularly in the political and diplomatic world. And in that speech you just quoted from, he really outlines for himself what he was going to do. I don't think he, and this is interesting because what he was set to do was to become an academic, and he was an academic basically all his life, which is one of the reasons why he was so successful in the UN, because he had a very powerful analytical mind. And it was fired by a passion for justice and a passion for trying to resolve problems from which many human beings suffered. And he made it a rule that there was no human problem which was not susceptible to some kind of improvement, no matter how long it took, which is one of the reasons why he was such a good negotiator. And I think that it is an extraordinary thing to see a young man who would come as far as he had already, sketch out almost unknowingly the course he himself was going to take.
In the documentary, you talk about the importance of drafting in peace negotiations or in drawing up the League of Nations Charter, something you said Bunch was especially good at throughout his career. Can you elaborate on this and suggest what Bunch could do so well that is still crucial for negotiations of all kinds today?
Or it will be. Well, my sort of vision of Ralph, who is, I think, the person I spent more hours with in my entire life than anybody else, is of him hunched over a legal-sized pad with a whole supply of pencils and writing in longhand a whole number of things, mostly formulas to try to get around problems that had come up during the day. And he was a great perfectionist. As I said, he was an academic. And Ralph's great genius was to be able to listen all day to two or three or whatever it was sized to a conflict, and then to in the night to write up a form of words which they could all accept, which would mean you could move forward. Of course, the great classic example of this was the armistice agreements between Israel and her five Arab neighbors, which he drafted and got agreed on in 1949. But he could do this. This was one of the reasons why he was so good in negotiation. He could intuit in his own mind the problems and the fears and the difficulties of the people he was dealing with, not least the kind of reception they were going to get when they went back home if they had given away too much. And he could get all that working with the objections they had made to some previous proposal. And he could reformulate that proposal in a way that would give everybody just enough leeway to get through. It's something that very few people can do. And to do it, you have to have, first of all, an enormously acute analytical mind, and secondly, a very great capacity for understanding the difficulties of other people.
What you're talking about is a capacity for empathy as well.
Absolutely. I mean, somebody once said that one of the generals who Ralph employed in somewhere, I think in the Middle East, once said that Ralph had the kindest eyes that he'd ever seen. And I think it was true. He was a person who really had an unusual appreciation and liking for his fellow human beings. And curiously enough, it's not necessarily a very common quality. He really cared about the whole idea of helping people in trouble, and those were the people he was interested in. He was surprisingly little interested in very important people, celebrities, that kind of thing. He really didn't mind about them at all. But he was deeply interested in the lives of ordinary people and how you could improve them. And that gave him a very great motivation for getting on with these extremely difficult subjects, these situations.
Did he also have a skill for being present and, I would presume, an extraordinary skill at listening?
He was an incredibly good listener. In fact, I think it was Moshe Dayan, who was at that time an up-and-coming general in the Israeli army, who once described during the armistice agreements, he said that Bunch would sit there for hours and just looking at the person who was speaking absolutely unmoving, and you could somehow see this knowledge being received into some central area of his brain and being sort of filed accurately so that he could pull it out later on. And he was a very, very good listener.
Sir Brian Urquhart wrote Ralph Bunche, An American Life. He was a colleague of Ralph Bunche's and himself a former undersecretary of the United Nations. I'm Paul Ingalls, and you're listening to a Peace Talks radio special, Ralph Bunche, A Profile in Peace. We're spotlighting the late diplomat and scholar and Nobel Peace Prize winner who died in 1971. Later in the program, we'll hear from his son, Ralph Bunche Jr., as well as award-winning filmmaker William Greaves, who produced the documentary Ralph Bunche, An American Odyssey. We're going to hear an excerpt from that film now. Sir Brian Urquhart and other historians and principals in the 1949 Middle East Armistice negotiations recalling the mission that won Bunche and the UN the 1950 Nobel Prize for Peace. The documentary was narrated by actor Sidney Poitier.
In his opening statements,
I can readily think of a million ways to stall, delay, obstruct, and stalemate these discussions, should anyone, you know, care to do so. There are many eyes focused on what is happening here. You cannot afford to fail. You must succeed. I have faith that you will succeed.
Bunche arrived in Rhodes in January with really no guidelines for this at all. Nobody had ever done this before. The Egyptians had a problem because they had told their people that they were winning, but of course they were losing. The Israelis had a problem because they were determined to fix the Egyptians in such a way that they really give far more than they thought they were going to give. And that was a problem for Bunche, because he had to try to moderate the Israelis, get them to accept things they didn't want to accept, and at the same time produce the absolute minimum the Egyptians could get by with their own people in Cairo. And it was an immense task.
There wasn't such thing as a working day. There was simply work. Occasionally he went to sleep, others went to sleep. One didn't worry about when one day ended and the other one began. The chances were you were involved in a process where every opportunity had to be seized to try to push through an agreement.
Bunche writes to Ruth,
"This is killing work. I haven't been out of the hotel for 2 weeks now. I talk, argue, coax, threaten these stubborn people day and night in an effort to reach an agreement. Sometimes I feel that I should just tell them to go home and forget about an armistice."
Rhodes was a very curious place. There was nothing to do in Rhodes in winter, nothing. The only recreation was billiards and ping pong, both of which Bunche was very good at.
Bunche writes,
"There's a cat and mouse game going on here between each of them and me. They would be happy if I would terminate the negotiations and just relieve them of any responsibility. But I'm not going to take that rap."
All of a sudden, one morning, somebody came, a messenger from Bunche, saying he would like to meet all the members of the Israeli delegation in his bedroom. We were a little startled, but okay, we went. And in the meantime, he sent another messenger to the Egyptian delegation, telling them that he would like to see them in his bedroom. In the bedroom, there was a large chest of drawers. Ralph had had two sets of dates made, marked Rhodes Armistice Talks, 1949. He opened the drawer and said, "Now look at these lovely plates which I prepared specially for you. When you sign the agreement, each of you is going to get one of these plates as a souvenir of these negotiations. But if you don't reach agreement, I personally will break these plates over your heads." Of course, everybody burst out laughing, and that was the end of the impasse. This was a typical Ralph Bunche maneuver.
1 p.m. Wednesday, February 23rd. The Egyptians return from Cairo with the full agreement of their government. Bunche schedules a simple signing ceremony for 10:30 a.m. the following day. Within 1 year, Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria will each sign a similar agreement with Israel, drafted by Ralph Bunche.
An excerpt from the William Greaves documentary, Ralph Bunche, An American Odyssey. More now from our 2007 conversation with Sir Brian Urquhart, former Undersecretary of the UN, who worked with Bunch for over 20 years. He spoke with us from his home in New York City.
The 1949 negotiations were extraordinary enough to merit Ralph Bunch the offer of the 1950 Nobel Peace Prize, which you say he actually tried to turn down. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Ralph was a very unusual public figure. He loved the work and the responsibility, but he hated all the celebrity status and all that kind of thing that surrounded it. And he wrote to the prize committee which is in Oslo, which is a committee of the Norwegian Parliament, and said that he was very grateful for this honor and so on, but he couldn't accept it because he was a member of the UN Secretariat, and he was just doing his job, and he wasn't really doing that job in order to get a prize. Well, that, all hell broke loose. Nobody had ever done this before, and the Secretary General was a Norwegian, Trygve Lie, who called Bunch in and said, "You cannot possibly refuse the Nobel Peace Prize. This is a prize which is of enormous value to the United Nations, and you have to accept it." And more or less ordered him to take it, so he did accept it. But it was very typical of Bunch. I mean, one of the difficulties about trying to get people to understand how extraordinarily important Ralph Bunch is, even now, to the future, because of all the things he did and the ways of doing things which can be still used and so on, is that he himself never told anyone about anything he'd done. He absolutely refused. He never boasted about anything. I mean, when I started to write I'd been with Bunch day and night for nearly 20 years, and I thought I knew all about him. And when I started to write this book and got into his papers and everything, I discovered that I knew virtually nothing about him at all. I had no idea of the things he'd done. He was a very unusual person in this way. And I rather wish he'd been a little bit more forthcoming, because I think people might have understood what an extraordinary figure he was. I mean, a figure of enormous importance for the 20th century.
Well, you mentioned some of the other things that were groundbreaking that he and you worked together on. Israel, Britain, and France collaborated on an invasion of Egypt, in part to take the Suez Canal and overthrow Nasser in 1956, I guess. And
yeah,
Ralph Bunch is instrumental in setting up the first UN peacekeeping mission.
Well, this is a typical case in point. Ralph actually had set up the first peacekeeping operation already in 1948, which was the Observer Group in Palestine, which incidentally still exists. It's called the United Nations Truce Supervision Organization in Palestine. It still exists in a rather reduced form. And this had the kind of basic rules which peacekeeping demands: the complete impartiality, the non-use of force by the group, and so on, and never allowing either side to get an advantage through the agreement. Peacekeeping was a concept which was very much developed by Bunch himself. It was using soldiers in a completely non-fighting capacity. That is to say, they're not allowed to use force except in self-defense. And in fact, it was something which the military in most countries thought was a lot of absolute nonsense. And it took them a very long time to discover that it actually could be made to work very well if it was backed by a powerful political leadership which kept it on track. And that's very much what Bunch provided. He also, in 1956 at the Suez Crisis, was very anxious to show that we could do this. And then we had to work out all of the details, you know, how it was going to act, who it was going to be, how to get it there, how to feed it, who was going to command it, and so on. And I think most governments thought, well, this will be a matter of a year or so. I mean, it's just one of those things the UN does. It's a nice idea, but nothing really happens. I remember vividly, Bunch was absolutely determined to show that that wasn't going to happen. And in fact, we had far more offers of troops than we needed. And he put together a force of some 6,000 troops in a matter of days. I think I'm right in saying 8 days after the first decision to create this force. This was something nobody believed possible, and indeed you can't do it now either. Bunch did it, I think, simply by working. We worked all day and all night getting this whole thing ready. And there were endless problems.
Well, I love that story about the plan to use berets, but they would have taken 6 weeks to
Order. Well, this was I was actually, curious enough, the only person in the Secretary General's office who hadn't had military experience. I'd been in the British Army for 6 years during the war. And so I actually was, I think that all that experience is quite useful. I thought we should, in order to emphasize the peace, the peaceful nature of this force, they should wear blue berets. And then we discovered it took 6 weeks to get 7,000 blue berets made, which was hopeless. And then I had the idea that we should take the plastic helmet liner of the American battle helmet, which is really two helmets, and have those simply spray-painted UN blue and put those on the troops as they arrived. And the United States cooperated wonderfully. They had them all ready in about 24 hours and sent them to Ismailia, where the soldiers were landing. And so we had them all dressed in blue helmets the moment they got to Egypt, which actually, curiously enough, symbolically, was very important because they showed that they were different from the British or the French or the Israelis, or indeed anybody else comes to that. They were something special and new.
Right. Finally, you said that you learned more from Ralph Bunche than anyone else. When you think about him fondly, what has stayed with you over time that really resonates in your heart about your association with him?
Well, first, what stays with me is the extraordinary integrity of Ralph. I mean, it was absolutely impossible to get Ralph to do something he thought was wrong or underhand or dishonest. Completely impossible. He wouldn't do it. Secondly, an amazing modesty. The grander Ralph got, the nicer he became and the more fun. He was a most friendly, incredibly kind, wonderful friend. I mean, it took about 3 years to get Ralph's confidence. But once you got it, he was your friend forever. And he was friends with a surprising number of people. Mostly people who worked for him and got to know him well. I think that his intellectual ability was somewhat concealed by his kindness and his kind of lack of pretension. He had a formidable analytical intellect, formidable. And this came into play all the time on serious problems. And I think he also was capable of innovating without even knowing he was innovating. I mean, he just thought of things in the middle of the night. For example, one of the things in armistice agreements, which is now quite common, is the demilitarized zone. If you can't agree where the line goes, you create a zone called the demilitarized zone, in which no soldiers are allowed from either side, and leave the question of the exact line out for the time being. He invented that. He invented a whole number of things as he went along, without even knowing he did it. He just was a very genuine, an extraordinary person, quite the most remarkable person that I've met in public life, I think.
Sir Brian Urquhart, thank you so much, first for your service to the world and also for sharing your memories about Ralph Bunche with us today.
It's my great pleasure.
Former Undersecretary of the United Nations, Sir Brian Urquhart. He worked with Ralph Bunche and authored the biography Ralph Bunche, An American Life. I'm Paul Ingalls, and you're listening to Ralph Bunche, Profile in Peace, a Peace Talks radio special. When we continue, Ralph Bunche's son, Ralph Bunche Jr., and later film documentarian William Greaves. All after this break.